Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Thank you for joining us today. On our program, the Valley's largest school district adopts a plan it hopes will limit concussions on the football field. And parents in one Northwest Fresno neighborhood say their schools are deteriorating and they demand changes. Are theirs isolated concerns or symptoms of a bigger problem? And life is what you make it. Musician, composer, and author Peter Buffett talks about his recent book and upcoming appearance in Fresno. But first, last week, the California Air Resources Board approved a plan intended to bring the Valley's particulate pollution levels into compliance with federal standards. But residents and health advocates expressed concern that the plan doesn't act quickly enough to protect public health. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports.
The San Joaquin Valley's polluted air is a daily concern for Mario Talavera of Fresno.
When I go to the pharmacy, they ask why I need medicine. For Mario, Angelica, Tomas, Jose, and for me too, Mario, I have asthma. The only person who doesn't have asthma is my wife.
It's a constant stress for Fresno resident Teresa Vidales, too. Her husband, a construction worker and the family breadwinner, has asthma. One of her four kids does also.
He is the only one in the house that works. I worry that if he gets sicker, what am I going to do?
Talavera and Vidales are members of Latinos United for Clean Air, a Fresno-based community group. Last Thursday morning in Bakersfield, they shared their family stories with the California Air Resources Board. They urged the board members to turn down the Valley Air District's plan to meet a federal air quality standard. They said it didn't move fast enough to reduce air pollution or go far enough to protect community health.
In reality, we have had some victories, but like I said during my testimony, it's at a tortoise pace. The efforts to reduce pollution go at the speed of a tortoise, and the pollution, the sources of pollution, move at the speed of a hare.
In the end, the board voted unanimously to approve the plan. But some board members said more needs to be done, and faster, to clean up the region's air. Valley cities like Bakersfield, Fresno, and Visalia consistently top the American Lung Association's annual Most Polluted Cities list. Here's Dr. Alexander Sheriffs. He's the Valley's representative on the State Air Board and a family physician in Fowler.
The plan provides significant improvements in air quality, and we need to grab what we can grab. This is clearly going to lead to definite health benefits, both to individuals and communities, but it is never fast enough.
The plan in question is intended to bring the Valley's levels of PM 2.5, or fine particulate matter, into compliance with federal regulations. Particulate matter is made up of a number of components, like metals, soil or dust particles, and allergens, like fragments of pollen or mold spores. According to the EPA, PM 2.5 describes particulate matter that is 2.5 micrometers in diameter and 1/30th the diameter of a human hair. These fine particles can aggravate heart and lung diseases and have been linked to heart attacks and asthma attacks. To a regular person like me or you, understanding the plan and how it's going to work is like trying to see the Sierra Nevada mountain range during the winter. It's practically impossible. So I went to an expert who could explain the region's air quality problems and how the plan will solve them.
What is true about our air quality challenges in San Joaquin Valley is, first of all, there is no other region that faces the same degree of difficulty and the same high levels of air pollution that we face in San Joaquin Valley. And a big part of that is because of our geography, topography, the climate conditions, basically a bowl with a lid on top of it.
That's Syed Sadradeen, the executive director of the Valley Air District.
This particular plan was aimed at satisfying and meeting the standard for the PM 2.5 standard that EPA published in 2006. So what is in this plan is a collection of some of the rules that were recently adopted to meet some of the other requirements in the Federal Clean Air Act and a few new ones that we thought we need to meet this particular standard sooner.
But what does this mean for the daily lives of Valley residents? Will Barrett is a policy manager with the American Lung Association in California. He explained that the Valley Air District aims to reduce fine particulate pollution by further limiting when residents can light their fireplaces.
So on days where the weather is going to basically trap smoke and wood smoke close to the ground where it does the most damage to people's health, there'll be more days where the Valley will identify, you know, when it's not healthy to use fireplaces in your neighborhood. So you don't want to have lots of that wood smoke stuck around in the neighborhoods where it can really affect people's health, especially people with respiratory illnesses like asthma and other lung and heart diseases that are affected by fine particulate pollution.
The Valley Air District aims to amend the fireplace rules in the coming year, with the goal of implementing the new rules by the 2014-2015 winter season. Under the new rules, district officials predict the number of so-called no-burn days will significantly increase throughout the valley, but they expect households with EPA-certified stoves will have more flexibility. And here's the big question. Will this plan make a difference for the families of Mario Talavera or Teresa Vidales or the 17% of Valley residents suffering from asthma? I threw that question to Caroline Farrell, Executive Director of the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment.
Based on the Air District's projections, we're going to have to wait until 2017 in 90% of the valley to have healthy air, and we're going to have to wait until 2019 for the Bakersfield area to have healthy air as far as particulate matter.
It will take several years for this plan to successfully reduce the amount of particulate matter in the valley's air. And even then, Farrell stressed, residents will still be contending with other pollutants, too.
There's still ozone, there's still other contaminants, greenhouse gases, methane, these things that are not being dealt with as part of this plan. So this is only a small segment of the burden that everybody's carrying. So it's an important segment because it is ultrafine, it has the most immediate health consequences, but it's one part of many parts of a kind of pollution picture that we have here in the valley.
During last Thursday's meeting, members of the State Air Board also addressed this quandary, that even if the plan leads to reductions in PM2.5, Valley residents will still face other health threats due to the dirty air. Mary Nichols of the State Air Board emphasized that there's a difference between meeting regional clean air standards and ensuring that Valley residents, especially those living near roadways, breathe clean air on a daily basis.
Even if we were to meet the standards, we need to be doing more in those parts of the state where people are exposed to the worst pollution, and this tends to be correlated heavily with being in a low-income community, being isolated, racial minorities.
Nichols said she's optimistic that recent legislation passed as part of AB 32, the state's cap-and-trade program, will direct some money towards reducing pollution in disadvantaged communities.
We need to be directing more attention and more resources in the direction of helping to improve overall exposures in those communities.
Or, as Will Barrett of the American Lung Association put it simply, we all want to see clean air yesterday. The State Air Board will next bring the plan to the U.S. EPA for final approval. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
It's a burn day.
With the Super Bowl just around the corner, the topic of terminal brain injuries from football has become a concern across the nation, especially with head injuries making the news, much like Junior Seja's family suing the NFL over claims that the former linebacker's suicide resulted from a brain disease produced by the constant hits he took in his football career. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero explores the measures Fresno schools are taking to stop head trauma caused by football among the city's youth.
The way Fresno High School football coaches run off-season training this spring and summer will be different than in any training season prior. The reason? Off-season tackling has become a major no-no. In an attempt to decrease the number of football-related injuries among Valley youngsters, mainly concussions, the Fresno Unified School District enacted a new policy last week to ban full contact during the off-season. So what does this mean for Valley football players? Tackling or hitting won't be allowed in practice, at scrimmages, or at football camps from December through July, even though tackling in the offseason has been a regular practice at the high school level. Bullard High School head football coach Don Arax said he supports the district's decision fully.
The bottom line on this is we have to be proactive on this issue. This issue's not going away. There's a real threat to the future of the game. It's not like when I played, or even 10 years ago, where if a kid got a concussion, he took a few days off and then was right back on the field. We want to take care of our kids as best we can.
The decision to stop contact during the offseason is a first for the Fresno area. The policy comes after a study of former NFL players was released in September 2012 by the journal Neurology, finding that players were unusually disposed to die from degenerative brain disease, which may be caused by concussions and repeated blows to the head. The study has caused alarm over whether contact football during the offseason is necessary at the high school or collegiate levels. Even President Barack Obama chimed in on the topic last week in an interview with the magazine The New Republic, saying that if he had a son, he wouldn't allow him to play football, and that he fears for the well-being of college football players. Chris Van Ness, a parent of a football player at Bullard High School in Fresno, said he's glad the decision was made. Vanessa's son, Tanner, was a victim of a concussion last season.
Something you can't control, right? And it's not something you can go and fix or get taped up and go back in there. It's a serious injury. And, you know, he wanted to be back out there, but knew that he couldn't. And he can cause a lot more harm to not just sports, but his future in general.
Arax said that he doesn't expect the ruling to affect his team in any adverse way.
I think it's a good decision, and I don't think it's going to hurt the level of play.
But Arax pointed out that he thinks the initial policy is just the beginning of regulations to come to high school football in Fresno. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Now, the policy to regulate off-season football contact in Fresno schools couldn't have come at a better time. In this segment of Valley Edition, we discuss the issue of physical contact in off-season football and the brain trauma associated with the repetitive hits from that sport and others. Joining us today is Jim Krishlaw, commissioner with the CIF Central Section in Porterville, and Dr. Robert Cantu, who studies traumatic brain disease at Boston University. Thank you both for joining us this
morning.
You're
welcome, Juanita. You're welcome. My pleasure.
Let's start a little bit with what we see Fresno Unified doing. What are your feelings about that, and what kind of impact do you think it can have when it comes to other schools in the area?
Well, as far as the CIF is concerned, we are definitely championing that idea, and in fact had proposed to our football advisory committee last week prior to the announcement from Fresno that we do away with camps during the summer, or if we have them, limit them to one camp during the summer for a maximum of 2 hours a day, 5 days total. And then Fresno comes out with that announcement last Friday. So we are definitely in favor of doing something along those lines and tightening things up.
Do you think, Dr. Cantu, that we might see other schools doing the same thing across the country in light of this new information we have? Well, it's not new information. People have known about it, but it's really getting more noticed.
Well, I think, as we outlined in our book, Concussions and Our Kids, the important thing is taking and reducing as much unnecessary head trauma as possible. And that can be done most easily by dramatically modifying how teams practice. And the National Football League has kind of led the way. Now they only hit with full contact practices 14 times in the 18 weeks of the season, and they don't do it in the off season at all. They still have practices, they still have drills, but they're skill drills, and they're not padded up.
So there's a way to do this. Now, the government is conducting, after all of this information has come out, especially about concerning football players, specifically Junior Seja, that the government now has announced that it's going to conduct this sweeping study of sports-related concussions among young people. Now, do you think this is something that should have happened sooner in light of the information that we've been getting?
Absolutely, yes, but it's very understandable why it hasn't. At the high school level, and certainly at the college level, you have medical personnel at the scene. You have athletic trainers, not in every school, but certainly in most at the high school level, and definitely almost all at the college level. So accumulating medical data is pretty easy. But at the youth level, you don't have medical personnel on the sideline. You have well-intended coaches that are usually not even trained in those kinds of things. So it's a very difficult thing to get statistics at the youth level. So therefore, it hasn't really been studied.
And we're not just talking about football. You see concussions a lot in soccer players as well.
Yes, yeah. It's absolutely true, and especially for young ladies, soccer is right at the top of the list. And the
as well as girls basketball
is one that's particularly dangerous in soccer.
Yes, you were saying, Mr. Krishna.
Yes, I'm sorry, Doctor. I didn't mean to.
Sorry,
but
I didn't.
Girls basketball is also one where we are finding many concussions throughout it. And you mentioned soccer. Wrestling is another one. The head hitting the mat. There's quite a few. In fact, we have a survey out, and we're hoping to have some data back by the 1st of March from our section here to find out how many concussions we've had and what has transpired with those students after the concussion.
Dr. Cantu, when we talk about these repetitive hits, you know, how can these continual blows that these young people are taking, not just from football, but like you said, soccer and wrestling and some of the other sports?
Well, fortunately, most kids at the high school level are not going to take enough trauma to set themselves up for the later life issues that befell Junior Seau. That having been said, in a case in a series of 68 cases of chronic traumatic encephalopathy that we recently published in Brain, there were six cases out of the 68 that came from high school. The great majority, 33, came from the National Football League. The next greatest number was college guys who never played pro ball, but there were six high schools. So it can happen from only your experience at high school, but it's much less likely.
Mr. Krishlaw, with this kind of information, and I'm sure additional information they're going to get from this huge study that they're doing, what kind of impact could this have on high school sports?
I think the biggest thing is going to be the education of coaches and getting them back to teaching the drills, as Dr. Cantu mentioned, that they need to teach on proper technique. You don't need to use your head as a battering ram in all cases for tackling. You can use your chest, your shoulder, and so on. So I think technique and education will be a big factor. And then just a little bit of preventative headgear for 7-on-7 games. There's a soccer-type helmet you can wear that's tubular that protects the head a little bit. So there's some things that I think as we get further into this and some newer products come out to help protect students, that education will be the big key.
Also, Mr. Krishlaw, so far Fresno Unified is the only school district that has said that it's going to take those steps. So far, Clovis Unified hasn't said it was going to follow suit at all. Do you think we'll have a situation where there are some school districts who decide to do this and others don't? Or at some point, do you think there's going to be uniformity?
Well, I believe there'll be uniformity. Kern High School District doesn't allow it now. We've talked in meetings with superintendency throughout the section. They're all for it. So that's, again, we proposed a language change in our bylaws that will bring this to fruition. We will discuss it at a section-wide meeting tomorrow and vote on it in May, and I expect it to pass in some form, which could include no contact all summer or to the point of one camp possibly. So I think there is a movement section-wide here in the Central Valley to do away with all contact during the summer and off-season for that matter.
Okay. Dr. Cantu, you mentioned yourself in a book that was written. What have you all found when it comes to the repetitive hits that young people take in these sports? What have you been able to determine thus far?
Well, what's rather surprising is the number of them. A high school football player over the course of a season may take as many as 1,000 or even some higher than that hits to the head of greater than 10 G force, which is a pretty reasonable hit. Not enough to give you a concussion, but certainly enough to jar your brain around. And as you've indicated, what we found at the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy is it's just not concussions that count. It's total hits to the head. No one knows the exact ratio of how many 10G hits is the equivalent of a concussion, but it certainly is known now that you can have chronic traumatic encephalopathy without any recognized concussions if you've had enough total brain trauma. That also, though, opens the question, many individuals, for instance, Junior Seau, never had a recognized concussion during his entire NFL career. To say that he never had a concussion, though, I suspect, is far from the truth. He probably had many. They just weren't recognized.
Well, in light of that, how do you, because you, as you were saying, in some cases, these young people or professional athletes can be injured without understanding just how badly they've been injured until somewhere down the road, maybe when they're out of the sport.
Well, the recognition of concussion is recognizing an athlete has had symptoms that are symptoms of a concussion after a hit to the head. And those symptoms fall in four big baskets: cognitive symptoms such as difficulty remembering and thinking, the types of things you need for schoolwork; emotional symptoms, which characterize usually by loss of impulse control, loss of ability to handle frustrating circumstances, and depression. And then in addition to that, sleep symptoms, sleeping more than usual, less than usual, or trouble falling asleep. And lastly, the physical symptoms such as headache and lightheadedness and dizziness.
Mr. Krishlow, as far as the symptoms that he has pointed out, is that something I'm sure that high school coaches might be aware of these symptoms? Do you think there should be more of an effort really to kind of not only educate them, but educate the parents as far as what to look for?
Yes, indeed. In fact, in California now, every coach must be certified to have taken a class in concussion recognition and what to do with student-athletes who are possibly concussed. There's also an educational program that we really recommend for parents to go online and take. It's just a real quick little 5-minute, 10-minute read-through. Here are the symptoms, here are what you should do, so on and so forth. So, yes, education is extremely part of it, and the state of California is one of the ones leading the way for all coaches to have that certificate in concussion recognition and along with the CPR and first aid cards that they are needed.
This is a question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Dr. Kan, too. Depending on what these studies show, because, you know, we've had other studies and now we're going to have the sweeping studies, what kind of impact could that have on the way we play contact sports, like football, soccer, and the others?
Well, I think it's going to have quite an impact, and I suspect that it's also going to have an impact in terms of just how many collision sports you let a child play. It's been very common that your very best athletes that like the physicalness of football and like the contact of football and are very good athletes often go from football to ice hockey to lacrosse in the spring. And that's kind of setting somebody up to take an awful lot of trauma over the course of a year and obviously even more over the course of their high school career.
You're right about that. That was one of the things I thought about. If you have a young person and let's say they start playing sports at an early age, let's start even in junior high, and then you go through junior high, you go through high school, and then you play in college, and then you play professional sports. When you take a look at that, it does give you pause to think about that, just how much hitting is going on and what's happening to this young person's body.
Well, the other thing, too, that's particularly of concern to many of us is that the young brain is particularly vulnerable to brain trauma. The brain is not fully myelinated. That's like the coatings on a telephone wire. It helps transmission, but it also gives support. So the young brain not being myelinated is much more easily disrupted. In other words, axons torn and injured in a permanent way. And young brains have big heads on weak necks, and the bobblehead doll effect makes them more vulnerable as well. So we're very concerned about what age you start these collision activities. And I personally, for one, don't think starting them off at age 5 or 6 or 10 even is reasonable.
Mr. Krishlaw, what do you think about that? Because you know what? We do see that. We see, you know, we see young people, some as young as, you know, in kindergarten, and their parents have already put them in a contact sport. Is that something we might see change? Or they could play the sport, but maybe not in, when it comes to contact. And I'm talking about soccer and some of the other ones, because sometimes with football, they do have to be a little bit older.
Yeah, I've seen some issues with it with the younger kids. One of the particular problems with the younger kids playing tackle football, as the doctor mentioned, that the head being like a bobblehead effect. Well, also the equipment, because a lot of the programs throughout the valley and throughout the state, or the nation for that matter, can't afford to have perfect fitting helmets for a 7, 8, 9 year old kid. So that can create an issue in and of itself. A simple rule change. The NFL is offering $1 million for people to drop their tackle football programs and go to flag football at that age, heading the ball in soccer. Maybe a rule for youth football, youth soccer, is you cannot use your head to head the ball. That could be a possible rule change to take things away. But we need to do something. There is no question about it, to get away from these young student-athletes who are coming along and the possibility of them being concussed at that early age.
Do you think that the more parents are made aware of this, that they might take those steps themselves as far as whether or not to let their child at such a young age play? And, you know, the more and more information we get about contact sports and the impact it has on a young person's brain.
Well, I would hope so, but like everything else, it's that individual parent, what their decision is. It's so hard to legislate their thoughts, but I would hope to heck that they would sure consider all of that.
Well, you're right about that. When it comes to sports, a lot of times, you know, you don't know. Dr. Cantu, I would like for you, if you could, just to kind of sum it up as far as where you think we are when it comes to really studying traumatic brain injuries and young people, and what else needs to be done.
Well, I think we know some things, Juanita, and they're almost self-evident. Number one is that no brain trauma is good brain trauma. Let's not get worried and paranoid about it, because we're all going to have brain trauma and hit our heads as we go through life. But it's not a good thing to repetitively do it if you don't have to. And so let's take out the unnecessary trauma that we can from sports and make the sport safer. And I agree completely with Mr. Krishlaw that part of that is proper technique, proper blocking, tackling, so on. The thing that we don't quite have a handle on today is that some individuals who are exposed to the same amount of brain trauma as somebody else winds up with a later life progressive neurodegenerative condition like chronic traumatic encephalopathy, like Junior Seau had. And other people who seem to be exposed to a similar amount of trauma don't seem to wind up with that progressive neurologic condition. And why one person or persons get it and the others don't, that's what we're really trying to get our arms around. And right now, we don't have good explanations. Lots of theory, but no fact.
Well, at least now it seems like a lot of people are on board with this, both in the sports world and in the medical world, and we'll hopefully get the right answer soon and really give parents the information they need to make the right decisions. Mr. Jim Krishlaw, Commissioner with the CIF Central Section in Porterville, and Dr. Robert Cantu with Boston University, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Juanita, for having us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I am Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
On today's edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Professor Jack Benega says new standards for public school education need further scrutiny.
If you have children or grandchildren in our public schools, get ready for the next great curriculum shift. Our schools are about to change again, and this change may be for the better, except for one glaring omission. The new approach is based on a set of standards that will replace No Child Left Behind, President George Bush's contribution to American education. In the near future, we will have standards called the Common Core State Standards, the collective efforts of 46 states to establish a national set of academic benchmarks. By 2014, teaching approaches in our schools will have changed focus, with comprehension taking precedence over deciphering, and depth of mathematical understanding replacing broad coverage. All of this has rightly excited educators, yet the loser in all this hoopla is the same topic that was the loser under No Child Left Behind. In reality, we do need students to read carefully and well, and we need to provide students a deeper understanding of mathematical concepts. The question is, why do we need such understandings? And the answer must be larger than simply economic progress. If we can't go deeper than this, then what distinguishes our American schools from those in Venezuela or China or Iran? Schools in those countries focus on student academic achievement as well. The difference is that a prime purpose of education in America is to educate students to build and perpetuate our democratic system. To do so, they must become aware of democracy and what it means. But we have let down our guard. The state of California requires study of American history and government in grades 5, 8, 11, and 12. In fifth grade, students are to study the development of America up to 1850, with the establishment of the colonies and our founding principles. But history in the fifth grade is not part of the assessment system, so most teachers find little time for it. In eighth grade, the focus is the American Constitution. Until recent years, Fresno Unified students, for example, could not pass eighth grade if they didn't pass a Constitution test. But today, that requirement has been dropped. In reality, not reaching proficiency on the eighth grade or 11th grade assessments in history carries no real ramifications. It doesn't really matter. Recently, I interviewed a number of principals for a Character Education Award. I asked about their school's role in perpetuating democracy. At first, they did not make the connection between their curriculum and American identity, American values, or democracy. However, most quickly understood, but concurred, that the connection is simply not made explicit in education today. As a result of such oversight, many potentially good student experiences and rituals are overlooked that could enhance understanding of both character and citizenship. For example, at one school site I visited, the daily duty of raising and lowering the American flag was the custodian's. Students were not involved. Overlooking even small rituals like these is a missed opportunity for meaningful transmission. As citizens of the United States, we are right to be concerned about the education of the next generation. We want our children to be academically proficient. But economic strength is only a partial purpose of our schools. America must continue to set a standard of openness and freedom, of respect for equal justice under the law, and for civil discourse. Those, above all, are the purposes of our publicly funded system of instruction. We should not lose sight of them as we once again rethink the goals of public education. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. When 500 parents turn out to a community meeting to voice concerns about the schools their children go to, people listen, or they should. The meeting called by groups called Reform Fresno Unified and Bullard Committee focus a lot of attention on Bullard High School and its feeder schools, Gibson Elementary and Tenaya Middle School. But committee members say it is a community-wide concern. Joining us is Charles Manick, a Bullard parent and a member of the Bullard community. We hope to have Fresno Deputy Superintendent Ruthie Quinto at another time. Now, Mr. Manek, first of all, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
I know you're busy, so we appreciate your time. Bullard parents have been complaining for a while about problems in their schools, including overcrowding conditions, discipline issues, lack of academic programs. What were you hoping to accomplish with the community meeting held last week or a week ago?
Well, it goes back, again, you mentioned it goes back years and goes back to support for Measure Q and some promises that were made on Fresno Unified's part to put into place a Bullard Regional Plan. And the Bullard Regional Plan, which was drafted by Mr. Hansen and Fresno Unified, included in it a number of programs, much of what you talked about. Since the election, there had been no performance on those promises. We talked about a GATE program. We talked about uniforms at the school. We talked about the issue of what are you going to do with Wawona and districting? How do you fix those boundaries? A greater say at the design of Bullard, et cetera. Those kind of things which were put in writing, which were looked at by Fresno Unified and just then died. So in the meantime, we felt in the community that these issues had to be addressed right then, at the time that Measure Q was passed. Since that time, there has been more and more of a community effort. And when I say community effort, I talk about the entire city of Fresno in terms of what's going on with Fresno Unified. Are we being served? And so there has been a wider group of people, both from the Bullard community as well as the entire city, who have gotten involved in these issues. Bullard happens to be at the forefront right now only because it had the first meeting, but there will be more meetings.
Well, you're an organized group of parents and concerned citizens.
Yeah, let me make this clear. There is a group called Reform Fresno, of which I am not a group. I am not a group member. That Reform Fresno, which was really the driving force behind this meeting, is looking at Fresno Unified as a large bureaucratic problem that is not servicing its students and looking at it citywide. I'm a Bullard community member. I'm an activist for Bullard. I have a son at Bullard. I've had kids at Bullard, et cetera. So from my standpoint, it's part of the bigger picture of what do we do here with this large Fresno Unified.
Do you think specifically after the last meeting, you all did turn in your concerns to the district? Are you confident that you're going to be able to have this dialogue? Are you hopeful that something will come from this?
Hopeful. In the past, we'd actually had some success in dealing with the district. You know, there were various things done at Bullard, the aquatic center and the football field that wouldn't have got done other than being able to work with Fresno Unified. Now, at the same time, those same plans and construction, et cetera, that got done as a citywide approach, which was every district was going to benefit from approaching their facilities. So, yeah, I'm hopeful. However, in the past, we've been shut out. And as you can see in the newspaper and in the television reporting, we aren't really represented on that board, on that school board. There is hostility from a number of board members towards Bullard, in my opinion.
That was my question. Do you think politics on the board has hampered the kind of progress the community has called for, specifically in the Bullard area? There's no secret that the school board member who represents the Bullard area and the superintendent of Fresno Unified do not get along. Do you think this had an impact on you all being able to move your concerns forward?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Fresno Unified is a extremely large, one of the largest districts in California, and there are a lot of holes in the dike, and there's only so many fingers. And so when you add politics to dwindling resources, then those dwindling resources, it's really easy to make choices if you have a political bent to say, no, we're going to get to you last. Before the law changed and it was a citywide election for board members, Fresno was a much different – Fresno Unified was much different in terms of how things got done. In terms of political leverage, Northwest Fresno, which voted, the majority of votes came from and still do from Fresno Unified. I'm sorry, from Northwest Fresno. Before that law changed, there was leverage from the Northwest, and so there was some balance, but still not a great amount, but still some. Once that changed and it became a district election, most of the board members had no reason to look to anyone else other than their own district, and so the district at large became balkanized, and so that lends to a fractious board, which is not looking at the city as a whole, but looking at their own individual districts. It's a lot what's wrong with politics today, frankly.
You know, and often, and we've read and we've heard, when it comes to Bullard parents, you all have been kind of written off, called a bunch of elitist parents who think you are entitled to the best. And, you know, as a parent, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I always laugh about the elitist comment because if anyone ever went to that community, if anyone went to the community meeting and saw who was on the stage and saw who spoke, they would understand that it is a multicultural, socioeconomic, diverse group that is dealing with this. I don't know any community in Fresno that doesn't believe their children deserve the best. And so it's interesting to me to see when someone says, I want the best, they put labels on it. It's just to me, it smacks of manipulation of public stereotypes.
Bullard, the diversity of Bullard, if people don't know, it has changed. I went back and I looked at the numbers, and it's a very diverse campus and a very diverse neighborhood at this point. But as you mentioned, parental involvement, community involvement is always touted as something being good for a neighborhood school. And so to have that huge group of 500 people show up, that's a huge statement in a way.
Absolutely. And I think that maybe differently than in the past. In the past, there was a small group of Bullard parents who were waking up to the fact that their school was being harmed. And they were desperate about making changes. That was a small group of people. This group now, when you talk about 500 people, when you talk about citywide approach, when you talk about it represents truly everybody in Fresno, that's what we're talking about now. And I think that the Fresno Unified Board will have to deal with this because it's not just going to be Bullard. There's going to be a meeting coming up at Roosevelt. There's going to be one at Hoover. There will be one also at each one of the schools, Edison. Each school in turn will have their own community meeting, which will be much the same as the Bullard meeting.
Some of the concerns that you've raised when it comes to academics, you know, we can look at in the Fresno High area, they have the International Baccalaureate program. Edison High School has a great program with its Computec program. Both schools have seen renovations and upgrades. I mean, is that what you all are talking about as far as having some kind of a – when you talk about having upgrading academic programs, is that what you're saying you want to see in the Bullard campus? Or do you think people just assume these things are already there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think part of what we're doing is trying to have public awareness of where we're coming from. But I can tell you that one of our main concerns when we did support Measure Q and said, look, in return, we need some help here, was GATE program. And we wanted a GATE program which was rival to anything in the district. I believe that every district in Fresno Unified deserves a GATE program. And that's what I'm a proponent of. But I think with regard to Bullard, we were promised a GATE program and they didn't follow through. So what's happening is a lot of these children that live in our district are being bused to other schools to get those types of programs, and you're having what's, you know, in essence a brain drain.
Do you think, you know, there was a movement a while back, and even there was a study done, I can remember years ago, that suggested Fresno Unified breakup, that suggested that Fresno Unified was too large to truly address the concerns of the kind of diverse student makeup it has. Is that still an issue, you think, or do you think it will ever be brought back into the discussion?
It's absolutely an issue. In fact, Pete Mihas is who you're talking about in terms of who brought that up, and the splits, which have to be along social, economic, and racial grounds so that it fits within the federal model. That's something that is Reform Fresno is looking at and looking at very seriously. And there's a number of people who signed on to Fresno to Reform Fresno that in fact are looking at that. Once you get to about 35,000, the studies go, you're too big. And we can see it in Clovis now. Clovis is now seeing some of the same growth issues that Fresno Unified has been dealing with for years. You just get to an inefficient point. You can have a joint powers, you know, if you split it and deal with the economic aspect where you have buying power, you still have economic leverage. But in terms of providing services, absolutely. You're talking about smaller districts are able to provide better services. All you got to do is look at, for example, Sanger. Sanger delivers product education to Latino and black students at a much better, efficient quality.
It's a very good school district.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons for that is size. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. If you talk to anybody out there, that's one of the things that they say. There is no reason. In fact, I think it's criminal that Fresno is not providing those same services to their blacks and Latinos in students here in Fresno. If we don't change that trend, we will never change that trend, and we'll just be another huge, inefficient, garbage, in my opinion, unified district. There are great things going on, but it's too big.
Well, Mr. Manek, Charles Manek, a Bullard parent, a Bullard activist, but saying that what we're seeing with this movement is a community-wide effort to change Fresno Unified District as a district. Thank you, Mr. Manek, for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, he is an award-winning musician, a composer, and author. He has turned his latest book, Life is What You Make It, into a conversation, a presentation, and he's bringing it to Fresno. Joining us now is Peter Buffett. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's great to have you.
Thanks very much. Very happy to be here. Very much to be here, too.
Well, I think a lot of people are looking forward to your upcoming concert that is going to be at Fresno City College soon. And, the first question I have for you, when I think about and I read about all that you have done and you've accomplished, you know, is very interesting. That, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, that your father is probably the most well-known investor in the country.
Absolutely.
Warren Buffett. But, you know, when you read about all of his children, including you, you all have taken a very different path with your life and even with you going to music and writing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really why I end up coming to places like Fresno to talk about things like that. I was just kind of putting one foot in front of the other, doing what I do, and found my path. I was very fortunate to work in the music business in a variety of ways, writing music for commercials and film and television and all that. And then I sort of joke about the fact that I recently became Warren Buffett's son because nobody really knew who he was when I was a kid and doing my thing. And now that I'm older and people are looking at me and saying, wow, you seem so normal, I realize that how I grew up, the values that my parents gave me, the kind of world I lived in, which was surprisingly normal and typically Midwestern, is sort of a lesson in what it, what wealth and privilege and all those things really mean, because the privilege was having parents that loved me and believed in me and allowed me to get out there and find, you know, my own path, but didn't do it by writing checks. You know, they did it by allowing me to fall down and figure out how to get up. And so, again, I found that my story as simple as I thought it was actually valuable, you know, to other people in terms of, you know, what's really meaningful in life.
And you know, and you use that, and you use a very good example. There's a very good example in your book when you talk about life is what you make it. You talked about your own journey and how you came to music, and the fact when you talk about your father letting you all find your own way. Because and you write about it, and you talk about how instead of, you know, leaving your investment, your inheritance, you used it to kind of help launch your career.
Yeah, well, again, you know, growing up, I didn't see my dad making a lot of money. I saw him doing what he loved, and that's a big difference. I did not know that he was making a lot of money because that was never the point for him, and so he didn't spend it. You know, we didn't have all this lavish stuff that people, I think, might imagine. And so seeing somebody love what he did every day, you know, that inspired me certainly to try and find the same thing. And I went off to college and then realized that music was really going to be it for me. And my grandfather had left us some money, actually. He left us a farm, really, and my dad sold that farm and invested it. And so, and this is a story I go into more detail in the show, but I used that money to invest in myself, and it wasn't a lot, and I knew I wasn't going to get any more. You know, it's not like my dad said, well, here's some money, and if you mess up, well, I'll give you some more. You know, it was very clear that this was a huge opportunity to potentially, you know, invest in my own future.
Well, you know what? When you look at what you've done, you were part of MTV from its early start. Talk a little bit about that when you talk about you know, you did commercials and other things.
Yeah, well, and it's such an example of sort of dumb luck and then being prepared for it when it comes along. I knew I wanted to get into music. I also was very pragmatic in terms of wanting to make a living at it, and I found that things like commercials and that sort of thing were a more direct way to still, you know, love writing music, but again, have more of a steady job in a sense. And I had moved into a new apartment in San Francisco, and an older guy was out front talking to me. I hadn't met him before, and he asked me what I did, and I told him, and he said, well, you should meet my son-in-law, because he creates these funny little animated things all the time. And this was back in 1981, and I met this guy, and he was creating some funny 10-second commercials for a new cable channel. And, you know, I was paid $1,000 for 10 seconds of music, and that sounded pretty good to me. And so I did a bunch of them, and lo and behold, it was MTV. And so there I was, suddenly, you know, sort of cool by accident, because I had done these things, and everybody wanted to look and sound like MTV. So that really launched my commercial music business, and it just happened to be because I was having a conversation with my neighbor.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your tour, your program that you are bringing to Fresno. Life is What You Make It, a concert and conversation with Peter Buffett. Let's talk a little bit about that and what people can expect.
Well, I call it a concert and conversation because it is, in fact, both those things. I'm at the piano, and I play with a wonderful cellist who is worth the price of admission. He's just so much fun to watch. And so the two of us will play music, but it's really to punctuate the story that I tell. Again, a lot about growing up and the path I took and various things I've learned along the way, lots of multimedia, so lots of images of growing up in Omaha and pictures of the family and old MTV commercials, you know, so video as well. But the conversation part is in a way the most fun because I take questions through the whole show. Anybody can ask me anything at any time. So it's not me standing up there kind of broadcasting to the audience. It's really interactive, and that can be a lot of fun.
Tell us a little bit about the project that you did that helped you win an Emmy.
Well, it started really with my involvement in Dances with Wolves. That was sort of my 2 minutes of fame that everybody has probably seen or certainly heard of. And I wrote a piece of music in that film, and I tell the story about how that happened in the show. But then that led to a very deep and long-lasting relationship with the American Indian culture and my interest in it and working with it. And so I had scored a couple of PBS shows and actually one also for network television. And one of those won an Emmy, as well as some music I did for a show about the state of Wisconsin, actually. That also won an Emmy. So it's been fun to be involved. You know, I do them because I love the work, of course, and to be recognized is, that's always nice, too.
And you were saying this is all going to be a part of your concert?
Well, I do touch on almost, well, I would say for sure everything we've talked about and more. I show some clips, whether it's from Dances with Wolves, or I play some music from some of these shows I've done. I'd like to point out one of the fun things near the end of the show is I actually display my dad's middle school report card, because that's a lot of fun to see.
Oh, wow. Everybody wants to see that. You're right.
Not everyone's perfect all the time, basically.
Well, that could be an inspiration for a lot of people, I would think.
There is a huge sigh of relief from parents and students alike when they see my dad's report card, definitely.
And look where he is today. Well, yeah. Peter, again, your concert is entitled Life is What You Make It, A Concert in Conversation with Peter Buffett. It is February the 2nd at 6:30 p.m. at Fresno City College in the old administration building auditorium. A really fabulous place to be. And there are still tickets for those of you who are interested. It sounds like a great evening, something you just really wouldn't want to miss.
Thank you. It's going to be a lot of fun, I guarantee it.
Okay, well, we're looking forward to having you. Thank you so much, Peter Buffett,
musician
and author. And that is all for Valley Edition today. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. Thank you.